There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, and welcome to the Progressive Britain podcast. I'm Joel Holland. For this episode, I spoke to Andy Laub, self-professed foreign policy wonk and next-gen fellow at Foreign Policy for America. We talked about Biden and Harris' first 100 days, the voting rights and George Floyd policing bills that Republicans are blocking in the Senate, and the big immigration and foreign policy challenges that the Biden administration faces. Andy, thank you so much for coming on the Progressive Britain podcast.
Joe, thank you so much for the opportunity.
So you're currently working on a mayoralty campaign in Westchester, is that correct? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, that is correct, Joe. I am working for, it's technically a town supervisor. So if we like to make things complicated in New York politics. So we have several villages that are within a town or a city and things like that. So I live in a small village that's part of a larger town. And I'm working for a man named Paul Finer, who's a well-known actually name locally, who actually has probably about 100% name recognition, mostly known for his constituent services, is that he's a person, we're a town of about 95,000, you know, or so, and he rides, you know, around in his car, in his old car, with a thing on top of his roof that says the mobile problem solver, town supervisor Paul Finer, with all of his contact information. He gives out his cell number, his email, and it makes a difference for people because, you know, you call him, you email him about a pothole in front of your street. He forwards it to the Department of Public Works. It gets done by the next day. And most recently, he created something called a COVID Angels program for the town, where a team of 200 volunteers assisted in getting over 4,000 seniors the COVID vaccine. So that was really something special. So he's more unusual of a politician. And he's really, he doesn't consider himself a politician. And 30 years into the job, he's still the outsider when it comes to politics. So that's, and he's who got me started. So that's sort of is what's given me sort of what I think is more of a unique approach to progressive politics in making that personal touch.
Very interesting. And it's primary season really, isn't it? Because there's also the New York City yes. mayor primary. Have you been keeping track of that? Have you been following it? What do you think about the current candidates and what chance they have?
Well, you know, it's sort of a weird kind of race. It's one where, you know, there's no clear front runner. Obviously it's an empty seat because Mayor de Blasio is not running again. So you have quite a lot of candidates. And we have something new in, not in my part in Westchester County, but in New York City called rank choice voting. So you pick, you rank, you know, who you're based on favorability, who your choice is for voting. So if you vote, so your second choice could also really matter a lot because those who are polling below, you know, who get a certain percentage, they're going to start to bottom out. And then that's where your second choice also will come in, you know, to play. So you really have to think about voting for two people, which is new for a lot of folks. You have obviously New York City in its own national, as you know, one of the biggest cities in the world, reputation. You have somebody like Andrew Yang, who ran for president on a universal-based income, giving $1,000 a month to every American. Now, sort of, he was very popular then. Right now, not as much. He started out with a lot of potential. The New York City press definitely can be a tough group, but he also, I think, in what a lot of experts have said, has made some stumbles when it comes to some of the things that he said. And he also doesn't really have that many ties to the city. But then on the other hand, the person who is the next in line, you know, who seems to be doing well right now is a man named Eric Adams, who is the Brooklyn Borough president. And what's interesting is he is, African-American, but he also is a former police officer and a more conservative Democrat who, you know, supports policies like stop and frisk, you know, when it comes to the police, which was a very controversial thing that from the last, you know, mayoral's race and in city politics. So it certainly is interesting. And with this ranked choice voting, it's anybody's game.
Well, members of the Labour Party will be familiar with ranked choice voting because the majority of our elections internally are now STV, single transferable vote elections. So we're very familiar with that.
Right.
And that's how the party now functions a lot of the time. It is shaping up to be a very interesting race, and New York, such a melting pot, but also people are so proud of being New Yorkers. And I do think that Andrew Yang not being from New York has hurt him over the last few months. And that was that there was that tweet where he was getting the subway up to the Bronx. And I think he said he was going to get the Bronx subway or something, and people did not let him forget that. So,
and then going to there's a famous club in New York City, Democratic Party club called the Stonewall Democrats, that are based on, you know, the incident that happened in the 80s with LGBTQ club was, you know, raided by the police. And he didn't do a very good job in his speech there by talking about his gay friend. It was seen as sort of an insensitive, not very smart approach to getting that group's endorsement, which of course he did not. Unsurprisingly,
it's going to be a very interesting primary. I mean, I assume that the primary is the big race, really. I mean, the Democrat nomination is going to be the mayor, barring some very, very crazy turn of events. So, really interesting to see what happens. Turning to a slightly bigger campaign, which you worked on back in 2012, yes. Obama's second race, to the White House. And I remember the first one back in 2007 and 2008 when I was following it from England, and there was this incredible aura around any conversation about Barack Obama, because he just was automatically such a hero over here. When you look at America over here, you see one of the primary things you notice is the problems of race that America's had historically and currently. And so just to see a black man with such charisma and you know, left-wing politics running for that for the role, it was such a hopeful time. And in 2012, I was actually in New York, and Obama came for the debate at Hofstra. I was unfortunately away with the football team, with the soccer team, so I didn't get to see him, which is my biggest regret for my time in New York. But I also remember in 2012, it was the same. The love for the man and the excitement around him was the same as if he was running for the first time, I felt. So what was it like for you being co-chair of students for Obama, correct, in New York? What was that like for you at the time?
Yeah, that's correct. And I also actually worked on President Obama's first campaign in 2008. And I was in, was on the ground, you know, for New Yorkers.
Okay.
For New Yorkers, the common thing is to go to Pennsylvania. And I was there on the ground in Pennsylvania in 2008. I was just graduated college right in the middle of the 2012.
Tell us about how it felt in both years.
You know, that's a great question, Joe, because in 2008, there was just such a hope. You could feel that hopeful energy you talked about. Because, you know, more young people than ever involved in politics, and, you know, people tired of the Bush administration and the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan dragging on. And here is just this hopeful guy that's really smart you know, guy, as you said, African-American, breaking down that racial barrier, you know, coming to chart a new path. And interestingly, in 2012, it was a little bit different, but, you know, there was a lot of that same feeling from those, you know, who really believed in him. But like, you know, after the 2010 election, where the Republicans took over the House of Representatives, you know, people naturally, progressives were naturally frustrated that more wasn't, you know, accomplished. But, you know, and there was more just negativity in the media about, you know, President Obama, you know, especially seizing on the Benghazi attacks by the Republicans, which I thought, and many as well, thought was disgraceful, and the killing of our Ambassador Chris Stevens, and turning that into a political talking point. You know, I think with all the hope that of being the first Black president, it also unleashed, unfortunately, a lot of racism on the other side that I believe were the same forces that led to Donald Trump. And we can, you know, talk more about that at some point or another. But so in 2012, there was just kind of a little bit more of a sense that, you know, the media just kind of portraying it that Obama was vulnerable and that Republicans picking. I mean, can you even imagine how the environment has changed? Mitt Romney was his opponent. But Romney also was somebody, as we see now, he's spoken out against, you know, Trump and has worked with Biden on some things, you know, and he even, I remember seeing when he voted against one of Trump's judges, because that person had said, you know, Obama was born in Kenya. And he goes, and this is personal for me because I ran against President Obama, but I in every way rejected that he was somehow not really an American. You know, okay, what happened to the politics of that? So I think there was definitely more anxiety that President Obama, you know, could lose. Certainly in the media, it was portraying it that way. But there was still, as you were saying, that sense of hope and that energy really for how important it was that he be returned to office so that he could continue doing the job, you know, that he was doing. And what we did at Students for Obama, where I was co-chair, as you mentioned, in New York, we sort of had an adopt a campus program where every school, you mentioned that you went to Hofstra, I went to not too far away, Fordham in the Bronx, where each campus in New York, a New York school, was paired with a Pennsylvania, had a sister school in Pennsylvania, where we would send our student and youth volunteers to go there and meet up with their counterparts in Pennsylvania and spend weekends, you know, canvassing and phone banking and just, you know, and this was also a part of the Biden campaign that I was involved with last year, was just having counterparts, you know, you became friends with and sort of where you adopted certain territories like Arizona or, you know, Pennsylvania, whatever it may be, for where, you know, you made calls to and such, or where you texted, you know, to a lot of different ways to campaign now in the hopefully soon to be post-COVID era. But, you know, that was one thing that was particularly fascinating with me, was getting to interact with universities throughout New York and in Pennsylvania, with having that same energy and determined mission.
And for our UK listeners, the fact that Pennsylvania is the place where you're doing this is important because that's a massive swing state with a huge number of electoral votes. And as I'm sure a lot of listeners remember from November, it's always very important in presidential elections. So if you're in New York, campaigning for the Democratic candidate in New York is often pointless, right? So there's use your resources and energy elsewhere. Really interesting that you say that you thought that after 4 years, some of the antagonism towards Obama was building up based on his race, even more so than it was before the first campaign. And of course, I remember that clip of John McCain as well, who was his 2008, running for the Republicans in 2008, where he turns to the woman in the town hall and says, no, Obama's not a terrorist, or, you know, Obama's a good family man. And it's striking that you say that, because you now look at the Republican Party and they seem to have lost almost every ounce of morality that they ever possessed. And Ta-Nehisi Coates, eight years in power by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Not sure if you read that. He's an Atlantic writer, philosopher, but he makes the argument that he thinks, like you said, Donald Trump came from 8 years of Obama, and that America was so angry. A lot of America was so angry that a black man had been in power for 8 years that they voted for the antithesis of Barack Obama. So you do see that as something central that happened in 2016?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's interesting because there was such a thing as the Obama-Trump voter, ones who voted more likely in 2008 for Obama also voted for, Donald Trump. People may, there certainly was a race factor, that's for sure. But also people, who felt a certain frustration, a generation of lost jobs from things, that can be blamed on, trade agreements like, NAFTA or other things, right? But also, so Trump's rhetoric in particular, that angry sort of confrontational style made it him seem authentic to many angry Americans in the middle of the country. But the jobs that he promised would come back did not.
And very different from Obama, right? In his kind of thoughtful, composed way of speaking. Trump is very different.
Very different. And Obama, the Constitution, we even see it with Joe Biden. President Biden, because, a lot of people said it's going to be a third term of Obama, even, his role as vice president. But you still see a different approach because somebody like President Biden, who spent, so many years in the Senate, versus somebody like Obama, who was new, who was a constitutional law professor, a thoughtful, deliberative guy, versus somebody like Biden, who wants to, make decisions, at a more rapid pace. He always complained during the Obama administration there were too many meetings. President Obama used to go around the room to everybody to say, to ask their opinion. And, he does the same thing with Vice President Kamala Harris, then having, the vice presidency be the vice president, be that last person in the room when it comes to making a major decision, especially when it comes to national security and foreign policy. But also it's just, a very different time. The world is not the same, as you well know, and you've seen, in the UK is in a very different place than it was when President Obama left office in 2016.
And one of those huge factors which changed the political makeup of America over the last decade or so was the 2008 financial crash. And we've had a lot of huge events since. I mean, the coronavirus, of course, and Trump's election was destabilizing. And there's been a lot of other huge global events over the past decade. But the 2008 financial crisis for me was the cutoff point between when my life as a child was kind of happy and normal. And then suddenly the whole world economy's collapsed and everything seems very real. You worked for Elizabeth Warren in 2000. And remind me what year was that?
It was her first election in 2012.
And how was that? How was it working with someone who was really one of the most outspoken people against Wall Street at the time and ran a very avowedly anti-Wall Street campaign, was kind of chastised by like the political director of the Chamber of Commerce, called the biggest threat to free enterprise in America. So what was it like working for her at that time?
I mean, amazing, because Elizabeth Warren is just so much, is just so, such a dynamic and special, human being in terms of how smart she is and how well she explains. She really thinks things through. If you recall her presidential campaign in the primary of last year, it was, she has a plan for that. So she really is a force unto herself. The Chamber of Commerce, of course, is quite a far right wing organization that likes to use hyperbole like that. But, and what I laugh when I sort of hear those quotes, because Elizabeth Warren is actually one of the biggest believers in free enterprise. Mm-hmm. And she actually, calls herself, a capitalist, but, an accountable capitalist, by making sure that such large financial institutions, sort of don't you know, get a free pass in terms of all the money that, you know, that goes around on Wall Street and how it has influenced, you know, politics as well as the economy. And that if certain, you know, regulations that are in place that can make sure that, you know, that's not necessarily anti, I know it's perceived by them as you know, like as you were saying, anti-free enterprise, but just making sure that there are rules in place so, you know, that we can follow to have it. And that's actually one of the big splits that she and her friend Bernie Sanders had during the primary in 2020. You know, Bernie Sanders had pointed out at one point, you know, Elizabeth Warren says she's a capitalist, you know, through her bones. You know, I disagree with that. You know, he's famously said he, you know, he's not a capitalist. He's a democratic socialist. So you did see a lot of people equated Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders during the primary. But you still saw, you know, even while both progressive, you still saw a much more within the system kind of reform minded focus among supporters of Elizabeth Warren versus those of Senator Sanders, who just kind of want to dismantle a lot of things, which is why in many ways he was compared to Trump. But in going back to your original question about how did it feel, you know, in 2012 knocking on doors, I mean, it was very exciting. You know, but it was also very, you know, divided. Massachusetts, as you well know, being given that we've given you New York citizenship, is quite a bit more, even though it is Democratic, but it's more culturally conservative than New York, you know, and places like Boston and sort of its old, you know, the old Irish, you know, heritage, you know, crowd. So people had a lot of feelings. She didn't win that race by a lot because she was going up against an incumbent, Scott Brown, who famously won Ted Kennedy's, you know, seat after President Obama was elected. So you had very mixed reactions in Massachusetts. You had people who loved her and people who hated her and were siding with Scott Brown. I remember just, you know, holding signs out for her, you know, out near Cape Cod and a traffic circle. And you got as many, you know, honks in support of her and as many thumbs down, especially from motorcycles, you know, folks, you know, that you did. So, you know, that really was the tenor of it. And it did, of course, help. And she, of course, did win. And it did help that it was a presidential year. We're in a state that President Obama won easily, you know, as well, that she could be running with him together.
And then her and Obama had a somewhat tenuous relationship, but she pushed him to start the Consumer Protection Bureau, right? And she was very instrumental in that. And I think at times, reading Obama's memoir, at times he was a little bit frustrated with the way in which she pursued it. But it just shows that no matter whether she calls herself a democratic socialist or a regulatory capitalist, she is she cares about consumers, about people, about citizens. And I have to try and be objective on this podcast, but I wish she'd won some democratic primary over the last few years, because I think she would have been excellent with as much power as you can give her, really. looking at the most powerful woman in America currently, Kamala Harris, and well, her or Nancy Pelosi, depending on how you look at it, and the president, Joe Biden, how do you feel about Harris and Biden's first 100 or so days? How do you think they've done? What's impressed you the most? I mean, they've spent almost $5 trillion. So that's something. How do you feel about it? What did you think they were going to do? And how is what they've done compared to that?
You know, I've been very impressed for the most part with the first 100 days, especially domestically. I mean, the COVID relief plan and getting that through, and not even one Republican, you know, voting for it. But, you know, they're happy when they get the money and they're happy to, you know, cut the ribbons at things that made it possible. But that was just a huge, you know, deal. Just because, you know, you have so, you know, cutting child poverty in half and, you know, just really in providing that assistance for people who are just in so much need was so key. It made a difference. And, you know, he almost made it look easy. And I think that is where President Biden's experience, you know, having been in the Senate for so long, really comes in, you know, key. You know, you have a proposed infrastructure bill America badly needs. And I'm sure, Joe, you know this, having been on both sides of the pond. Our infrastructure needs a lot of work here.
There are some dangerous potholes on the west of the Atlantic, for sure. Dangerous potholes. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, and yeah, there has been a lot of money spent. I think, you know, obviously we are going to need to look at the deficit at some point, but I think that you stimulate the economy first and get people, you know, you lift, help them lift off their bootstraps, like the way somebody, you look at the Bill Clinton model and how he was able to leave office with a surplus in the end. It's funny because many Republicans who have long cared and, you know, about the debt, you, if you recall several of the battles about raising the debt ceiling with President Obama, who long cared about debt, and we saw how much President Trump spent on tax cuts, you know, $3 trillion in tax cuts for the wealthiest of Americans. So, you know, I overwhelmingly approve of Biden and Harris, you know, things. And even when there have been controversial things like Afghanistan, you know, he didn't sit around and debate a whole lot. He kept his, you know, commitment. Nothing's ever going to be 100%. I wish that he would have publicly been in this most recent round between Israel and Gaza. I think that there was a chance to more publicly, you know, sort of help for the administration to mediate for both sides. I mean, they did do it. It's, again, something he learned while vice president. And he's obviously known somebody like Prime Minister Netanyahu for a long time. That it wasn't going to be as successful poking him in the eye publicly, but privately engaging with diplomatic, you know, engagements to help bring about that ceasefire. Of course, it's very tenuous. I wish he would have been out there, you know, a little bit more with it. But I think overall, foreign policy wise, engaging with our allies, especially NATO, which is a prized institution for both of our countries, and seeing what it went through under President Trump, former President Trump, I like to say, and now, you know, that recommitment on the global stage to our allies is just so key. So I've been, you know, quite impressed.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And he set his stall out very early, didn't he, on that first day with signing dozens of executive orders on some of the major things that Trump had, some of the major Obama advances that Trump had reneged on, and some, you know, additional terrible things that Trump had done. And that was a real, real huge sign when he did that. And it's felt like in 24 hours, the world had changed. But my question is, what does he have to do before 2022 midterms to make the Democrats do well in that election? Because like you said before, the 2010 midterms were Obama's downfall in many ways. And the 6 years after that, he had such limited power. So what does Biden need to do? What does Harris need to do before the 2022 midterms? And I'm asking this question on the anniversary of George Floyd's death, when the George Floyd Policing Act has still not gone through the Senate and the Voting Rights for the People Act 2021 is still languishing in the Senate. And there's a lot of bills that the Democrats can't push through without abandoning the filibuster. So what can Biden and Harris realistically do on these kind of these significant fundamental cultural issues and additionally in elsewhere in policy going forward to make sure that the Democrats do well in 2022?
Yeah, it's a great question, Joe. I mean, there's obviously so many different combinations of issues that you can, put together, especially for a legislative, item. And, you mentioned, the George Floyd Policing Act. There actually is there is some optimism on that. Republican Senator Tim Scott, the only Republican African-American senator, has been the point person of negotiation on this. I think that there are some disagreements between the parties on, how much you can and how far you can go in terms of the protections of a police officer versus the liabilities of them as well. So I think that one should have some more bipartisan support. But, you're right. You mentioned voting rights and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. So important, because we have seen since President Biden's victory, the Republicans do in states what they do best, and that is cheat. Things like voter ID. We've seen, the state of, Florida, potential Republican contender Ron DeSantis, sign a massive voting restriction bill, as well as in Georgia, a place that was so essential to President Biden's victory there, the first one since President Clinton in 1992. So I think voting rights are really at the top of the agenda, because on the state level, that's going to be something that the Republicans really look to help themselves in 2022. So I think passing the Voting Rights Act is very fundamental. And you have the Senator, Reverend Raphael Warnock, who won, of course, in Georgia, along with Biden, championing this bill. So I think there's going to have to be, between infrastructure, there is the climate change conference in Glasgow later this year. And I think, just showing how, tangible results for the American people, as well as that Voting Rights Act, because now that it's going to be harder to vote, especially for our more vulnerable communities that are supportive of Democrats, we need that protection, in there. So that, not only that we can win, but we can, sustain it before too much damage is done.
And it's that act is everything, really, isn't it? Because like you mentioned, Florida, Georgia, and I think the Arizona Republican legislature over the last couple of weeks has also passed a restrictive voting rights law. Mm-hmm. And I think I saw recently that there's a couple Republican senators who are saying they could get behind a milder, weaker version of the For the People 2021 Act, which basically reaffirms the 1965 Civil Rights Act. But I think the Democrats should reject that. I think they should go for the whole For the People Act 2021. But there's a 50-50 split in the Senate. So if the Democrats want to pass that, they need 60 to bypass the filibuster. What do you say to the argument that if the Republicans refuse and they're still reticent to support this bill, what do you say to the suggestion that Democrats should do away with the filibuster and just pass whatever they want, 50 votes, and give VP Kamala Harris the deciding vote for the next 2 years to pass whatever they want?
I think that there are inevitably going to be some situations where that's going to be necessary. We saw it with the COVID relief bill. We may have to see it again with the infrastructure bill. But you do see President Biden and Vice President Harris engaging with Republican leaders in Congress on an issue like infrastructure and stuff like that. I think on voting rights, I think you're absolutely right. I think we, unfortunately, as you know, we don't have active voting rights thing, because the Supreme Court threw it out a couple years ago. So I think I think that we're not going to see, unfortunately, just knowing Washington the way I do, we're not going to see any big changes with the filibuster anytime that soon. unless, you know, the 2022 elections turn out more to our favor. But yes, I do think that it has to be done away with because it's an ancient relic based on systemic racism and slavery, at the origins of the worst of America. So I think, you know, that it's necessary. You know, of course, you know, the Democrats did it, you know, something called several years ago called the nuclear option for certain bills where you could pass it with a simple majority of 51. And then the Democrats lost the Senate. So then Mitch McConnell was able to use that same tactic to get Neil Gorsuch passed as a Supreme Court justice after holding up Merrick Garland, now the Attorney General, when he had been nominated for Supreme Court.
Yeah, the most effective and frustrating instance of political gaslighting I've ever seen, I think, Mitch McConnell refusing to confirm Obama's Supreme Court judge and then doing the same thing in the last few days of Trump's presidency. It was, really frustrating. On the Supreme Court, what do you think about the idea that some Democrats propose of packing the Supreme Court? Because, of course, if we can't get the For the People 2021 Act passed, then the other way that states can combat these restrictive voting laws is by taking the states to court. But there's no point doing that if we don't have an amenable Supreme Court. So what do you say to the Democratic idea of packing the Supreme Court with more judges?
Well, you know, I certainly think it's an idea worth exploring, and I think, which is what President Biden is doing. History is unfortunately not on our side on that issue. As you recall, President Roosevelt tried doing that and was stopped, you know, from it. But it's also something along with the filibuster that's just going to be such a heavy lift in terms of doing and even possibly sustaining. You know, the Constitution does not specify a number, but, you know, there are all sorts of questions, you know, about it. But I think President Biden is going about it the right way by saying we should at least look at the issue. You know, you have now, you know, with unfortunately after progressive icon Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing, like you were just saying, and the way Mitch McConnell was able to get now Justice Barrett on the court and that 6-3 conservative majority. Yeah, that's a tough one for a lot of progressives, and you have a lot of issues like abortion coming up. Now you have states, Republican states, really looking to restrict it where they can and looking to get that up through the federal level, where Roe v. Wade is definitely in danger, and calls for President Biden to to codify Roe v. Wade in legislative language.
Two long shots, the filibuster and packing the Supreme Court. They just seem like definitely. Obviously, you're right about the point that the Republicans having that same power, you know, it's not something that bears thinking about. But you do look at the next 2 years and you wonder what might happen in 2022, and you don't want to see 2 years of a lame duck Joe Biden and 4 years of a lame duck Kamala Harris. That would be, too much frustration to bear. But turn into the southern border, because that's something that's been hugely in the news over recent weeks. Of course, Trump instigated Title 42, saying that you can turn people away at the southern border for health reasons, as a kind of ostensibly a COVID policy, but it matched Trump's antagonism towards immigrants. But Biden has kept that in place at the moment, and he's been criticized because then a lot of migrant families are sending children by themselves to the border, because Biden's policy is allowing children into the country, but not whole families under the Title 42. And it all seems a bit messy. Now, you were chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Is that correct? You assistant to the chair.
I worked for the former chair, congressman, who chaired the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Elliot.
And so were you involved in immigration a lot during that period?
That was my big issue as a liaison. Yeah. You know, I was, you know, sort of an interagency kind of person in helping constituents. So the big thing on the federal level is immigration, and just given, you know, and with the Department of Homeland Security. Now let's not forget the Department of Homeland Security is still fairly new in retrospect. It was only created after 9/11. So immigration always used to be, I saw my own grandparents citizenship placards, and you know, it said Department of Justice on them. So it's interesting, you know, that move. You know, America's immigration system is fundamentally broken. Let's be honest about it. You know, and in most of the cases that I got with immigration, they would kind of, the Department of Homeland Security would come back to me and say, sorry, according to, you know, the Naturalization Act of 1952, you know, that's really the last time a big thing was taken on immigration. That's a long time ago. Wow, you know, okay. We haven't really passed, you know, that many meaningful reforms. Now, going to the southern border, I think, you know, it has to do with really still getting immigration under control in the Department of Homeland Security. And the Department of Homeland Security, they need to hire many more judges. That's one of the things, because in immigration courts, and here's another thing that makes life more difficult. Immigration courts are then under the Justice Department. So you're dealing with all these different agencies and bureaucracies that just slow everything down and make it more complicated. So they need to have many more asylum officers down. This is obviously a problem President Biden inherited from former President Trump's awful, draconian, heartless immigration policy of separating children from their parents and unaccompanied minors. There's so many issues to resolve in immigration, but we fundamentally have to have more officers down there that can process asylum, seekers at a quicker pace, because right now the Department of Homeland Security just doesn't have the capacity. And that's where you see all those, you know, heart-wrenching pictures of people in tents and things like that. So that's a short-term thing, right? More hiring, as well as lifting the cap, which President Biden did after a little bit of backlash, for not doing it as soon as he was going to. But lifting that cap of refugees that we are allowed to, engaging with the UN and the refugee agency, and such, to have a more robust resettlement program. Those are some short-term things, but of course we need to pass, and this will be no easy feat, comprehensive immigration reform in Congress. President Bush tried to do it and couldn't. President Obama, even they had the votes in the Senate, but Speaker Boehner famously at the time wouldn't bring it up in the House for a vote. So that's what really needs, you know, to happen in order to sort of, as well as the engagement that's happening with Vice President Harris at the helm of the southern border, you know, issue, dealing with those triangle, you know, countries, restoring the aid to them that former President Trump took away, that so they can help stem the flow, you know, from them all the way, you know, to our southern border. So, but fundamentally, America's immigration system needs massive reforms.
And do you see those short-term solutions, Kamala Harris influence, like you say, in southern Central and Southern America, and the increased capacity, like you say, that is required for the two departments that work on immigration, the government? Do you think those solutions will do enough to stop immigration being a huge weapon for the Republicans in 2022 and 2024? Because we know they're going to use it. We know that they're going to appeal to people who voted for Trump. A lot of people who may have voted for Trump because of immigration, whether or not it's valid or, you know, is irrelevant. Right. Do you think that Biden can do enough in the next 2 years to stop that happening, stop that being a huge talking point?
I think that, you know, that's certainly an excellent question. I think that it's going to be a huge talking point. Regardless, I mean, but I think that there are, at least the path I think that we're currently on, there have been reports of facilities being less crowded and of reuniting more children with their families. There's a task force on that. So I think that there's definitely room for there to be, you know, through that engagement, you know, with Central and South American countries, where if we, stem it from being a huge, you know, flow, right? that it certainly takes the power, because as you said, as we said, they're going to use it no matter what, right? The Republicans, right. That's red meat for their base. But we certainly have the power to take that talking point more away from them by initiating these short-term reforms that can help alleviate the crisis. Yes, I do believe so.
Well, that's good. That's positive. It's very interesting that you say it's an issue of capacity, and to hear it from you, someone with experience in the area. So turning to more broader foreign policy issues, you spoke about them earlier. I think it's really refreshing to see someone like Anthony Blinken on the global stage instead of the people that Trump had running around with their kind of crazy and America First policy. How do you see these big challenges for Biden coming up? I think today Jen Psaki announced that he's going to meet Putin on June 16th, I believe, in Geneva.
That's correct.
So that's a big meeting. Do you think Russia is the biggest foreign policy issue for Biden, or do you see it as China? Do you see it as Iran? And how do you think, whatever the two or three biggest issues is, how do you think he approaches them?
Yeah, definitely all of the above. You know, it's... you know, as you well know, you don't get to a lot of times you don't get to choose, you know, the events that happen in the world. A lot of it is responding to it. We saw that with, you know, Israel Palestine just now, and we're gonna, you know, see it again with the Iranian elections in June, where there's poised to be a much more hardline president. Elected, and you have talks going on right now in Vienna that have made some progress, but you have to think that there will be some impact by those elections, even though both sides have played it down. Russia certainly, you know, you have to walk and chew your gum at the same time. President Biden has, you know, pushed, you know, definitely taken a much, as you were saying, somebody, you know, like with Trump's especially approach with Russia, right? You know, we know about that whole relationship that Trump and Putin had. And I think what President Biden has shown, and smartly, is that we can still engage with, you know, folks that we're in an adversarial relationship where there are serious disagreements, you know, whether it's on Alexei Navalny, election interference, hacking, right? Other things that we can still, you know, push back on that while still engaging, like signing a 5-year extension. Everybody thought the extension of the START treaty was dead because Biden was coming into office, and it got a 5-year extension almost just like that by both sides. Right. Because where there's mutual interest, you know, for, you know, big powers like, you know, the US and Russia, there will be that cooperation, and it's important for it to be. But yeah, I definitely think China, if I had to, you know, pick one, I definitely think China is really the big one, because while we see Biden taking a very different path on Russia than Trump, we're seeing some similarities on China approach in terms of taking a very, you know, tough stance. We saw not a very successful first meeting between Secretary Blinken and his counterpart and Foreign Minister Yi at in Alaska. You know, it's interesting how the Chinese have brought up domestic U.S. things like Black Lives Matter to show, you know, the human rights situation isn't so great in the U.S. either, for criticizing Chinese, you know, human rights. But China really is, because it is such an economic power, because, you know, it's making deals all over the world in places like Iran, you know, there where they, you know, trade oil in throughout the continent of Africa. You know, and obviously the contentious points with the South China Sea, Taiwan, you know, other things, you know, where they're in the driver's seat, and things also like, you know, disagreements of intellectual property theft. You're seeing that relationship continue to go in a bit of a negative direction. I think that a new Cold War is not in anybody or in either side's interests. So I do hope to see some more cooperation on things like, you know, climate change and other important, you know, issues. But we're going to continue to see economic competition as well as security, you know, areas where we are at odds with China on things like the South China Sea and the island and the territorial, you know, things that that they have. So I still think, given that, you know, Russia's economy is the size of Spain's, you know, with, you know, having such a population, China is catching up to the U.S. very fast, and especially with its, you know, population and involvement all over the world. So if I had to pick, I think that's going to be the defining, you know, relationship of global powers for, you know, the next, you know, at least next decade or so.
And how do you think climate change fits into that? Because we saw this very interesting dynamic for a couple months during Trump's second or third year, where you had President Xi in China coming out and saying, we're going to continue to abide by the Paris Accord, when Trump had pulled out. And suddenly it seemed like China might be the country to lead the world on green energy and sustainability. So how do you think Biden navigates that and takes the reins back for America? And how do you think that plays out?
You know, that's a great question. I think that, and sort of actually we've seen President Xi hesitate a little bit more in terms of, I mean, with the Paris Agreement and just being like, obviously the Paris Agreement couldn't have happened without the U.S. and China. India also is a very important factor as well. But, you know, you also have a lot of, you know, pollution in places like Beijing. You know, you also, so I think you can see the U.S. becoming more of a global leader again on climate change, because you've also seen sort of more of a hesitancy out of the Chinese government, given all of the hostility between the U.S. and Chinese governments, sort of being like, we're not so sure we want to work with you. Well, there's nothing more for us to do on climate change with the U.S. I think there was a statement from the Chinese government to that effect. So I still think, but it may not be that way either. It could also be a way where the U.S. reasserts its role. Talking about the Glasgow, you know, conference, it's a place for, you know, we have a special envoy, a familiar face in John Kerry, who's I always like to plug, was the first campaign I worked on in 2004.
Oh, really?
Even though that one didn't work out, he ended up doing some great things in his life and continues to do them. And I got to tell him, I went to a talk when he has his book. His book is called Every Day is Extra, because he talks about what it was like, you know, during Vietnam. And I got to tell him that he was like, you were my first campaign. And he liked that very much. So that was just a nice tidbit. But on the climate change issue, yes, this is a chance for the U.S. to really step up on its global leadership position with folks like John Kerry, who are well known throughout the diplomatic world, having been Secretary of State, you know, out there, as well as China. You know, there's still room, I think, for cooperation. I think it's a chance for President Biden and President Xi, who obviously know each other a long time, as well as leaders, for them to rally around to keep the Paris Accord right. So I see it as only hopefully being a good thing for both countries.
Very interesting. And coming to the end of the time here, but last question I want to ask you, and we can see if we can turn it into a positive one, because Jen Psaki did come out today with some positive news, saying that 50% of US adults have now been vaccinated, which yes, is fantastic. And Biden looks like he's on track to make his goal of 70% of Americans by July 4th, which would be incredible. So how does it look like from inside the US? Do things feel like they're getting back to normal? And do you think that if and when things do, that actually Biden might in a strange way lose some power, lose some impetus, and lose some of his mandate with the public?
No, I don't think so. But that's answering your second question first. But on the whole, you know, issue, it really is amazing. It really showed you, and this is something I meant to mention in your earlier question about how I feel about Biden-Harris in the first 100 days. I mean, wow, right? 55%. You know, they doubled their 100-day goal from 100 million to 200 million, right, of vaccines. I know I was very happy when I got my vaccine. And it just really shows you they were left with no plan by the Trump administration. we all know how terribly mismanaged they handled COVID. And it really shows you what competent, steady leadership can look like with experts who are focused and can handle this area. No, it almost feels weird having back to normal because we got so used to it, like the way we're talking, you know, now it's by Zoom and sort of working from home became sort of a custom way of life. But yeah, no, it definitely feels transformative. You, I mean, you see it, you know, New York City is reopening again. Movie theaters and restaurants and, you know, the mask mandates are gone. You know, you definitely see the comeback happening. And it's just something in our economy as well as, you know, in people's health. It was such a difficult time, as of course you well know and have experienced in the UK to live through. But it's such a relief seeing us on what appears to be hopefully the other end of it. And I think President Biden will be given and remembered very fondly as part of his legacy for really coming in and tackling this virus. So, you know, nothing but good things to say about that. And that's been such an important part of his leadership.
And it's just great to see Dr. Fauci getting some respect again and able to go on the airwaves and just speak like a doctor rather than having to bat away these ridiculous suggestions from Trump. And there was that scene where he's sitting in the White House press room while Trump is suggesting injecting yourself with UV light or whatever he was talking about, and Fauci's just got his head down, like really embarrassed. And we've come a long way from then.
Yes,
we've run out of time though, but Andy, it's been really, really interesting speaking to you, getting your hearing your experience and getting your expertise on these areas in American politics, which I think are fascinating everyone around the world right now. So thanks so much for sparing an hour to come and speak to us today.
Joe, thank you so much for having me on, and I look forward to further discussions of progressive politics spanning our across the pond.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.